really didn't want to follow that.
But I will. Alright. This is one I've been working on. Hip hop has this thing they came up with where they say there's somebody, they go like, "Bitch, I'm Tom York." And they do this kind of stuff where they're actually saying they're like, they are him, but they're at the same time they're saying they're not. The rest of the song has nothing to do with it. So this one is that taken to like a logical extreme. It's, I'm at 19 pages, there's 12 here, and it's gonna be 50 because I'm bored as fuck of poetry. So I'm just gonna like do something ridiculously over the top. This one's about the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is also the title. Laying our heads against the wind, against the cities and trees, no wave girls, in her camp out stepping on the decades behind them. Romantic red alarm warm, nerves tailoring to luckless carnal jolts, their inability worn hearts, hydroelectric sparks. Is it dreaming already of that fire that it'll become, of being shuffled by its own contentment, by what it was willing to endure and consent to? Double crossing their overeducation, defying it nightly, in showtimeness and lateness and shyness, all these things heroin worthy. Within being likened to another star, bored loose out of time, due anew, skin knee or skin deep, lemon of the juice, cooked till flawlessly removed. And to get very political, I see detectives trying to dance when I go out, autographing their own cast that they might summon themselves from outside this crime scene, but now all too serious, and they just might do that if nobody calls back. On a park bench, my jogging partners in the arms, later that night yet to move, open their eyes, their cell phone holograms right to the head and hand delivered. From the 80s movie night, grown atop the underground. So I get defensive when such beautiful seeds badmouth an escalating potency, and when his death an excuse to unload lessons from the opiate cachet. Cool. We don't normally fight for the eternal euphoric promises in one and another with our sexy malnourished selves. Back and forth on a country road, how many bags he had, how many keen to share your love with, and not lost enough, are at odds with every truth unsaid and dangerous to then be my own. Even more empty pages. So much for the myth of our language, some remote land gravel, high studio ceiling, room space, violent saps being brought to crescendos. It was the anti-suicide, and refusing to leave, another day once, another day three times. Frozen atop the painted over oceans, peeling the curtains open, the light let in. 20 feet from the nearest day nap couch bed. Further away by the days of the weeks in hiding, same shiny black embossed bug diamond soaking up closeness, cold sweat as rain on sand. Hotel lobby house pets, wagering the Beastmasters by the absence of their pack, and against their silly drug habits as debt lettering, both for their continued humor and health. But we're just native sympathizing spirits, so we're twice ill then, and self-inflicted by the culture, tricks for the dead, so simple, passed down to an audience miserable, thoughtless happy hanging out, doped on this control, as it disappears in coping with their own evil existence. Battle maidens, repurposed and out of body. Their returns in the live-through, feeling out for old senses, in the world no different, but the world resilient. Oh, and the award goes to the reward averted on the back of you, the world perverted if you could, then again, never meant in truth, only majority. And you for me, right? This isn't a religion. Grading who else rejected enough by opinion to fit in the concepts of the isolated. Isolated without wisdom to survive public perception meeting heroin. This complex entropy, running mad through the streets, dynamic ether to make solid the barriers versus the room itself, diamonds and negative recreations. It's only the beverages to wake up from. Strangely appetizing, a gulp and a spit leaves nothing but the preservatives in their stomach, and it's in the air anyway. Depression maximums. that there is always someone worse off to aspire towards, knowing the beauty even more when the beauty's shorting out. Their blank space and back pain, windows into our poverty, to destroy all that isn't meant to rise, rise in their multiplying internal dialogues. And of course, warnings hit with the first drink, but they'll shut up given time. The gadgets prepared to survive us for no other purpose. Passed out in the bushes, all the sharpened sticks to disremember the rigid event of the few personalities most are comfortable with. The awakenings of the aging to see these roles distributed quietly. And it won't look good unfinished. Tomorrow the same, conservative agendas give thanks to the frames of the brain spilling out, collected in password-protected magnetic tape. Learn as you go, and I'm sorry if it's been forever. In 10 years, this will be far less kind, maybe. Such grandiose private deception, facilitating smiles, dead gods bejeweled in the war trials, with these earnings that they who actually sacrifice what they own, so we can buy them everywhere, if you know someone special. Environmental softening focus could be your second of the night. And that much closer to bringing up what has fallen off and attacking the frontal lobe, I think, or cerebral cortex, save for everyone in the concrete baths ripping and tearing at a mind where the body cannot attempt to clear a path worthy of escape. Dreaming in king's fashion, fat atop presence, intelligence the luck at birth that now kills them, not a mistake, they chose at random. It is greed at the bottom, the weight of order, only to further poison the distinction between worlds. It was their protest to make the lottery fair, make themselves the faith test. If anything is ever possible, if limits devised in each mind, entertainment co-opting the psychic warfare, so they provide a welcoming to those on their drugs. Rebounding to the friendly fire flocks in the cookie jars, too stoned where the chocolate chip is a demonic invocation of prayers against the vacationing and non-participating players. Watch out, my kitty is Valkyrie. Thank you.
I was gonna recite the sequel of it from my memory, so hope you'll bear with me here. I'll be sitting down for this one. From dusk till dawn, troubling thoughts come to mind. Thoughts not so easily left behind. By the setting sun, my ritual has begun. Gathering all supplies, lighting the candle. My pen begins to write a token to gods and angels. Seeking answers with no lies, not knowing if I was in the right. I had but only one question, causing me nothing but eccentric confusion. What am I really meant to pay for the sins of my parents? Nothing could be more transparent. My mom is a person with very little an issue. A little more decent than my dad, I guess. With minor sins that few could pursue, all not so bad. My dad is a whole other story. A man with always looking for greener pastures. A human man with pride who's not sorry. Delusions of rage in a soul so immature. This being the reason why I am scared of what awaits. What happens to my soul when I die? Will I enter hell through the fiery straits? Or will I have done enough to earn my wings and fly? And there you go.
I have four poems for you tonight. Poem the first, "And Pretty Soon There Isn't Any World." When there isn't any world anymore, what is there to say goodbye to? When there isn't any world, is it a blank page to write on? Will there be silence? Can silence be heard? Nothing to see here, folks. Move along. Can I wait if I don't have to breathe? No world is not no dark, no light. It's an experiment. Pretty soon it's not empty or full of anything. The problem isn't the no world. It's the pretty soon. Poem the second, "Homecoming." Sometimes it's enough to tell just what happened, such as we got drunk and pissed out the second floor window into the trash can on the patio below, and Trick baked the snake, who was even drunker, into how to speak Thai, Awa Tana Siam. Mostly, though, when not working, it was long, peaceful bike rides past rice fields and woods, so quiet you could hear a cuckoo call a mile off. So quiet the separation from you hurt a little less. What happened then? Distance and time, long days and nights, the piece of dust that settled over everything. And welcome home, wipe your feet, put your bag there, and dinner will be ready soon, fading away into the time and distance. As far away as rice fields, where were you when I needed you? Third, to W.H. Auden. I love to march in boot camp, to be a metrical man. Plenty of form but no content, part of a metrical plan. The hills of San Diego in the corner of my eye, which I roamed free as an eagle in a free verse unmetrical sky. Only when my body was locked into motion, part of a company of recruits marching as one body, was I free to think and ponder, my shell of flesh on autopilot, the march a dance with caller and partners to martial music or none but the stamp of feet. My heart beat autonomously, my lungs took in the air that was, and it seemed fair to have no call to other duty than to face about upon command. Lastly, some offhand remarks. But you write poems about subjects, Wallace Stevens to Robert Frost. To live is never to see what is behind you without the aid of a glass, to see 180 degrees, half, and think it's the entire universe of consciousness except the stars, only visible without the competition of soul, and the soul, if it be, only perceptible without the interference across the visible spectrum of all the hard things such as tables, mountains, bullets, belfries, and soft things such as other people, the Pacific Ocean, custard and clouds. Most of us know we think, and some of us think we know, but living is mostly guesswork. And you, Wallace, you write about bric-a-brac. Robert Frost to Wallace Stevens. Nothing really depends on a red wheelbarrow, though it's too big for bric-a-brac, and the wrong poet anyhow, say, or the junk on my bathroom counter, the little ceramic sparrow on a twig, the carved stone turtle found in Turkey, the toy Porsche parked under the radio with the dead batteries. At least cleanliness and perhaps a little health depend on toiletries, and the medicines there keep my brain from doing the backstroke inside my skull. But the universe does not hinge on any of this stuff. It's not worth a poem even to say that. Though this is not fair to Wallace, I'm sure, as meaning is found everywhere, even in a hazelnut, if picked up and introspected by the right saint, say you. All are saints and poets who find the world in bric-a-brac. If stars behind the daytime lie, then what beyond the night might be? Until the world falls from my eyes, I shall never see.
Background on this poem. It's a poem about pasta, the shape tortellini to be exact. The shape was said to be created when an innkeeper witnessed Venus come into his inn and rent a room. And he was so taken aback by her beauty that he went up to her room after she had gotten settled and peeped through the keyhole to see whatever it was he could see. And all he could see by the candlelight was her navel. So, ran down the kitchen and created the shape of tortellini. So my poem is called The Navel of Venus, and it goes as such. Basic as eggs and flour, worked by the hands of a god, smooth and soft as silken sheets. In the hand, manipulated, delicate and toothy. In the mouth, supple and salty. Within the body, a round and unpretentious soul, alive, primal and beating, full fleshy. Savory and warm. Certainly in any, Venus was no outie. The plump teardrop of a navel, resting in this tepid sea, bones, water, broth, tortellini.
How's it going? You guys might have watched me walk in this door with a guitar on my back a few minutes ago, and you might be thinking, that dude forgot his guitar. But it's not like that. I was trying to get all proactive and tune my guitar in the bathroom earlier, trying to be all quiet and not disturb y'all, and I broke a string. But I write some stuff too, and I am a semi-organized artist, so I have access to it here on my phone. I'm hesitant to use the word poetry, but I write some stuff. This first thing I wrote it's kind of about growing up as the eccentric hippie kid in the middle of a bunch of rednecks who thought they were like homeboys or something. 32 teeth and 32 rounds of ammo, ready to go blammo, saying the wrong thing and it's time to meet Rambo. Say what you think though, because it's the thought that makes the man, yo, as long as it's not too homo, nouveau, or ghetto. But seriously, say what you think, yo. But first, let me lay out every line, consequence, and misstep, bro. Wouldn't want you to say the thing that springs the spring that means we can't be friends anymore, you know? But seriously, you can tell me anything, bro, as long as you roll like I roll, because I know you're not like them, these thems or that bozo, right, bro? We're the type that sticks together no matter what, right, Holmes? Tight no matter what, no? That's right, I knew you'd agree, yo. So many tiny things resting on my mind. Got to remember this all gets left behind. It's the feelings that add up to more than the grind. Every moment gets left so far behind. I'm reaching back, trying to unwind. Take a breath as I center my mind. It's these moments that get left so far behind. Everything is so open, yet I battle my own kind over these moments that get left behind. Together, if we reach back, maybe we can start to unwind. Maybe this will be the moment that you finally heard me. Better yet, maybe it's the time I forgot to worry about something that might hurt me if I wasn't so light on my feet. You can't blind me. My eyes are wide as I'm counting the beats, one step in the other as I'm avoiding sleep, calculating the moments that I'm bound to repeat, questioning the logic of the strong and the weak. Still, I find myself continuing the beat. Do I push on through or do I stop for a break? It's a quandary of moments. Which ones do I take? What decisions will I have the power to trade for an hour of peace in some future days? How many hours do I have already locked away? It's a quandary of moments. Speculation abounds. All I need to know is how it plays out when it hits the ground. Thank you.
James, I'm going to read part of my screenplay. Tell me if I'm going over. So. Exterior, old growth forest, mountain creek, dusk, establishing. The transfiguration of Gaia into corporeal form. Time passes through a mountain glen like eternity. Music, Etnoraku, Japanese court music. Close up. Drops of water dripping down moss. Pan across lichen-covered twisted trees. Push wide shot of forest, old growth, light slant through great trees, moss, stillness, and light eternal. Push in through tree, through the green chasm, waterfall, ancient moss. Close up of texture and lichen and bark. Sound of an owl, close on, mouth melts out of tree. Owl flies, close on, eyes transform from tree. Wind blows leaves, close on, hands melt out of tree. Gaia transfigures into corporeal form. A figure falls, moves, mutates out of the tree, half bark and lichen, clearly a woman, comes out with a moan and a sigh of wind and water, face down on her hands and knees, covered with bark, moss and lichen, struggling for breath, gasping like a childbirth, sensuous, struggling, writhing. Her body and face pasted, painted with bark, lichen. She stands like a goddess. She breathes, her lips open. The camera moves into her eyes, into her mouth. She walks through the green chasm, touches the moss, the stone. The camera follows her, hallucinogenic. She touches the water and kisses and drinks it. Gaia reflected in the water, luminous shot with green forest. She recognizes that the reflection is her being. Touches her reflection, stands and dances, touches her form. Shots going through rocks and moss of the glen. As a river flows, Gaia moves through the moss and the rock. Reflection shot. Gaia walking along the shore. We hear the sound of voices. The children seen in the reflection behind Gaia are following her. The four children of the apocalypse, post-human children, hold hands and dance. There is something smooth and strange about their movement. They almost appear to glide on without walking. Perhaps these future children are a dream of a woman who's trying to cross the border with her children and she is dying of thirst. Perhaps they are incredibly old beings. Perhaps they are simple, elegant, and beautiful, acting out an allegory, a parable, a fable. Perhaps they are just children playing at May. The May dance and Gaia is their teacher. Perhaps they are a little afraid. Voices of children laughing. They hold ribbons in the field of flowers and dance around. They rush and look intently. They laugh and sing. She is a goddess. She is a symbol of life on the planet Earth. She is the embodiment of life. Perhaps they are her future children. They will appear again. They dance around. It's springtime, when flowers come. We dance the dance of May, the dance of life, the dance of birth. Post-human child three turns to Gaia. You are the nature goddess. You are the earth mother. You stand for life on the planet, and you must speak. And the children all chant, Gaia, Gaia, Gaia. And it is as if Gaia is being dressed by the wind, a spiraling zephyr, rises, swirls around her, and covers her with leaves, moss, fireflies, and spider webs. The post-human children dance around her. She is awakened as a pagan goddess and she is wearing a dress of leaves. You will wander through the city. You will plead without mercy. We are here because of you. You're going to the city to speak, a child too. They will pin her in a glass jar like a butterfly. And then there's a post-human child standing, big hide, hair blowing in the wind, and she's saying, the wind is rising, the clouds are gathering, the storm is coming, you must speak. And they dance around, ladybug, ladybug, fly away home, your house is on fire, your children's alone. How am I doing for time?
2 minutes.
Got 2 minutes, good. The wind blows, the sky whirls, Gaia descends from the mountains, she is singing to herself. She walks down the mountain path. She is covered with leaves, and the silhouette of sunsets are filling her eyes, and as she touches a tree, she turns and takes one last look at the wildness. Perhaps she sees the children climbing up the side of a mountain. She turns and takes one last look at the great green, and the camera turns, and the camera pans, and she's on the edge of the highway, and then the traffic, and then the truck coming through the tunnel roars toward the camera. Headlamps, blare of horn.
Okay, I'm gonna change a few names if you don't mind, or at least one name. I don't want to get in any more trouble. Anthony Weiner, he was the local pervert among our friends. He was always up to no good. And he came to the party house on Monroe Street with a plan. Now, you gotta understand, at this time, the circus was in town, and we're not talking the old-fashioned circuses that travel in trains and have tents. This is like, you know, a modern circus. They perform in coliseums, and they put their animals at the fairground. So his plan was he wanted to have sex with a camel because he'd never done it before. I don't know if anyone in North America had, but he wanted to be the person. Naturally, I thought it was a really stupid idea, but that's where the action was going. We were all heading out there to help him achieve his goal, out to the fairgrounds. We had a plan. While he went in and accomplished his action, we were gonna stand outside guard. And if somebody came along, the plan was we'd toss a rock inside to give him a warning, you know? Well, I don't know exactly what happened, but at some point, somebody threw a rock into the animal shed and it hit the cage where the chimpanzees were. One of the chimpanzees reached out and grabbed the elephant's tail and gave a huge yank, and the elephant gave out this huge roar. The next thing you knew, that animal barn, the whole barn was in motion, and we were following along behind, not knowing what was going on. So at 2:30 in the morning, there was an impromptu circus parade on Clearwater Avenue. There were elephants, lions, clowns, tigers, zebras parading down the street, and even a camel with a half-naked guy on its back. And we didn't know what to do, so we tried to herd the animals back to the fairgrounds without too much success. And of course, you know, all this activity attracted the attention of the police. So that's how I spent my night in jail, if anyone wants to know. And of course, Anthony Weiner got no trouble at all. He got away scot-free. He got away scot-free. At the theater I worked at, not at this time, but later, we had this sex film event. And I looked at a catalog of so-called sex toys put out by this Anthony Weiner-like company. There were things in there like scalpels and stitches and catheters, and it seemed more like a medical supply catalog than something you would find in a bedroom. So I was just thinking, you know, it's odd that you can stock your 72-hour kit with medical supplies from a sex catalog. I don't know. Have a good one.
Osmond Creed. This one's called 28 Linwood. Bend me a bookshelf so my spider things stay, for dance with the children of sprinkler. Hold up fingers like bushes from potato chip bag, and we crack and grind pepper from licorice. I just want to make out like a bandit. Just want to rumble, strike, slip celery stalks. Want to pin it down because I found it. Want to crush up my bones into bricks for your walk. Want you see my slump and think snowdrift. Want plant sexed and study, want drip chlorophyll. I want to be the housefly buzz on your windowsill. Thank you. This one's called Jar of Fish, and it's a sonnet, a slightly imperfect sonnet, but still a sonnet. I searched for jarred fish at the grocery, a gift to send to my friend in New York. He don't have no pole or a fishery, just some buildings, a skyline, and a park. I wrapped the can in foam with my father. He done buzzard around JFK's death, placing wood pile high, this he would bother, cold air of dad and baked Alaska breath. And so jarred it sat on floor and corner with rhubarb and strawberry jam, for send my little friend in the city, for chisel her heavy rock into sand. Then got I bagged candy for my neighbor. Before send, I ate all on my Mount Tabor. This one's called The Renaissance, and it's the restrictions of the poem are that I had to write it in a certain, in the form of one poem, and then I could only use words from a couple of poems by another author. And I had to do it in like 10 or 15 minutes, so it's called The Renaissance. In the painting, the museum was the Renaissance here, small town castle, and looked the cosmopolitan in the mirror, raised an eyebrow, met a man I would choose, moving into me more and more, in a timeline of bridges, something happened. And its empire, he saw, white flower, to have the dinner on, it makes like sex, to have dinner and it turn into sex. But who doesn't, like the bookshelf, look great with white and blue teapots and bowls? Schoolgirl, she was silent. Was she dreamless as a television? Is it appealing to be straight, safe, and renovated delight? And be satisfied, and being satisfied prevents our delight. Oh yes, she said, she liked the opera. She said, sure. And then, how much time do I have? Okay. All right, this one's untitled. My mouth is a burning apartment building at night, in winter. My words awoken, escape frantically in their bathrobes and winter clothes. Their snow boots, clumsy and stumbling over big shovels for moving the snow. And sometimes my words are like droopy eyes trying to stay open, bearing down but drooping still. And the little words like no and yes sit on my molars like tiny cats mewing. No, what do you want to do, he said. What do you want? But I was taught to shrink down, taught to climb inside the microwave and revolve. I don't know when is the problem, when I went from pioneer speaker of the house on behalf of the Beanie Babies, a professor in a cowl neck demonstrating how to make chocolate by microwaving Hershey's syrup, how this mouse was beckoned back into crumbling tunnels with cakes of dirt and miniature candlelight, making love to the shiny thing stolen, and how now words roll off my tongue like bowling balls the size of crunchy cereal until the floor is a sorbet-colored chicken feed under my feet at the state fair with its funk and ribbons. And where do I find the girls who are 70% Coca-Cola and whose elevator eyes dismiss me like a dent in a gray wall? How do I extend myself outward through the snow and the junkyards to meet them? And why aren't they meeting me too? This one's called Little Chair. I have a little wooden chair. It was $10 at William Temple. My towel is draped over it to dry, its tiny loops matted over and bleached pink. My purse sits on its sloped bank, brimming with receipts, candy wrappers, old foil packets of birth control, and a gold Mardi Gras necklace that I didn't want. Next to the purse is a ceramic orange bowl with glassy olive oil pooling in the center, black pepper suspended in it like insects in amber. Next to the bowl is a bottle of oil and vinegar salad dressing, lukewarm like the lentil soup that's still in the microwave. Before I go, I shake the bottle and watch until the flurries slow and return. This is called Winter Birthday. It's inspired by the poems of Andrea Gibson. I swear my home is Vatican City. I will line the walls with my long shadow, my outstretched hands encrust a statue in tinfoil, and the heat rises up and boils over, orange oils pooling on pepperoni lily pads. And there's something romantic about tinfoil, and Tupperware is the opposite of romance, if there is one, besides the way you peeled off my tights and bunched them up, hungry and wordless like an animal. And I swear 21 is the last age I wanted to be, and my birthday is always cold. And so what if I wanted a grand gesture, a grand something, a grand central station, New York with its pea coats and hot dogs? This is what you know of winter. And I had my winter in a shoebox house, shut in, snowed inside, and white as snow. Springtime and a bead runs down my back, sweat and snow making small talk, then trading secrets. And I want to know what you carried around in your pockets as a kid. I want to know about the first time you did the wrong thing, got in a fight, shoved the kid's face into the dirt and felt sick about it. I want to light a cave on fire, let the bats escape and count them, sealing us off with a big rock and a long list of questions. What do you think about when you read the same sentence over? Does your mother like her water lukewarm or chilled? And when you heard the ice cream truck coming, did you run or were you still? You should have known everything I've ever let go of is framed in gold at the fire station, pressed with a blue ribbon at the science fair, or still flickers like the projector. And how much time do I have? Out of time. Thank you.
It was a fire. I'm sorry, I was sorry. There was a fire. Oh, I'm kidding. It's like radical change. All right. My name is Rose Drop Rust, and I have a poem and a news story. It's called Stung. Ever had something go so disastrously wrong, you wanted a time machine and a fucking stun gun? With the sordid plan in convoluted nutshell, we just go back to that stupid moment before when one could put just a little more thought became, what the hell did I ever do that for? In a poof, we'd return to presentable present, safely ignoring what we might still have done if we hadn't fallen drooling and twitching from the paralyzing effects of a mysterious stun. All right, now here's a story that someone posted on Facebook. I don't know whether you heard this story or not. Let me know if you had. The last thing the woman from Northeast Portland probably expected when she got up Tuesday morning was that she would be attacked by a sword-wielding elf. But that's what happened around 7 a.m. as she drove her red BMW by the intersection of Southeast 7th and Morrison. A man dressed in chainmail with a helmet, shield, and carrying a sword and staff ran into traffic and started attacking her car. She called 911, reporting that a pirate was attacking her car. When the police got there, they detained Conrad Bass of Glendale, Oregon. Bass told the officers that he wasn't a pirate, but a high elf engaged in battle with the evil Morgoth. Morgoth is a character created by J.R.R. Tolkien in a prequel to the Lord of the Rings stories. In the stories, he is the character from which all evil grew. Bass, who was cited for criminal mischief and transported to Providence Hospital, also said, also told the officers he had taken LSD. Her car suffered multiple scratches. Now, if one were a high elf and saw an attacking Morgoth, would it not be cowardly to refuse to engage it in battle? Further, if all evil coming from BMWs isn't really true, isn't it very close to the truth?
To share. One of them I ran across in high school, and I thought it was just kind of inspiring and just speaks of really what hate can do and what it can cause at the end. This poem was by James Patrick Kinney. It's called The Code Within. Six humans trapped by happenstance in bleak and bitter cold. Each one possessed a stick of wood, or so the story's told. Their dying fire in need of logs, the first man held his back. For of the faces around the fire, he noticed one was black. The next man sitting across the way saw one not of his church, and could not bring himself to give the fire his stick of birch. The third one sat in tattered clothes, he gave his coat a hitch. Why should his log be used to warm the idle rich? The rich man just sat back and thought of the wealth he had in store, and how to keep what he had earned from the lazy, shiftless poor. The black man's face bespoke revenge as the fire passed his sight. For all he saw in his stick of wood was a chance to spite the white. The last man of this forlorn group did not accept for gain. Giving only to those who gave to him was how he played the game. Their logs held tight in death's still hands was proof of human sin. They didn't die from the cold without. They died from the cold within. This next poem I kind of just wrote, and it's called The Cave, and it just reminded me of a personal kind of a story of how we kind of get into errors in our lives where we get stuck, and it seems like darkness and blackness. And so so this poem is called The Cave, and I hope it's inspiring in the end. My knees sink in my chest as I'm quivering in fear. In the pain that grasps my heart brings the darkness ever near. And although my eyes are shut, I can feel the blackness loom. In the tears that drench this moment, here is weight as in monsoon. I cower in my corner, in my weakness, here I lay. I can feel the cold beneath me, and these walls surround my face. And the thought of ever leaving leaves me struggling to find a hope that once engaged my heart and mind. I did not ask to be here. I did not ask for this. What sin have I committed to be locked in this abyss? It was my father's choices. It was his neglect that pierced the massive hole in the middle of my chest. My thoughts begin to wander and wonder, why me? As the rain falls on my cave and my heart begins to bleed, and the blood flows steadily and it trickles like a stream through the darkness of my shadows past the hurt of which I breathe. And although I could not see it, I can hear the blood had stopped. And I feel a presence enter. His light illuminates the dark, and he grabs my hands and lifts them to the air. Then he breathes upon my face, and I know that life is near. And he sits with me and listens to the rejection that I feel. And he quickly nods his head and affirms that it is real. Then he takes my hand and places it in covering my hole. And he speaks to me a promise. He will restore my soul. So strengthened, I sit up and gaze into his eyes. And with no words being exchanged, I knew I would survive.
Definitely inspired me big time. And all you guys have. Getting the Portlandia experience. Minnesota boy here.
Poetry in motion. Her pen bleeds her scars. She loves God more than anything. She speaks with the stars. Poetry in motion. Tears heal the weak. She loves God more than anything. More than you think. When we fall, he will call. Let him in. Life will begin. Poetry in motion. That's what we are. We love God more than anything. He lives in our hearts. Poetry in motion. Tears heal the weak. Love God more than anything. If the kingdom you seek, when we fall, he will call. Let him in. Life will begin. font, just a cappella, so I'm just gonna leave that thing right there. I didn't break a string in the bathroom, but I'm just gonna leave that sit. And it's gonna close out with this one song real quick. I wrote this song about a woman, they call her Phoenix. She was rescued, for lack of a better term, off of 82nd Avenue, where she was caught up in the sex trafficking industry. And there's a group of real renegades out there every Friday night called Hope 82. And they minister to these lost souls, and there's some incredible things happening. And I wrote this song about Phoenix, we'll call her. What's your name? God knows your name. Not the same, give him the pain. On the corner Friday night, in the darkness be the light, no shame. Yesterday's all yesterdays. Found a way to rearrange. In your name I will be strong. Find the will to carry on with no shame. No shame. No longer. No longer hold the pain. What's your name? God knows your name. It's the same, still the same. On the corner last Friday night, I met an angel.
Thank you so much, you guys.
Howdy. When I was 8, I cried at the end of Charlotte. Wait, how long do I have anyway?
7 minutes.
Okay, cool. When I was 8, I cried at the end of Charlotte's Web. And I vowed then, in honor of Wilbur, that so long as I lived, I would never eat so much as a niblet of ham again for the rest of my life. It was a vow which lasted all of 3 weeks. At which point, my brother eyed my slice of pepperoni and, claiming that pepperoni was pig, told me I should really hand it over. It didn't matter if this was true, I made my choice. And today, half of everything I eat is pig. Months later, I fell in love with E.B. White's other book, Stuart Little. So one day I saw a mouse run across the bedroom floor. So I ran and told my mom, who immediately pulled out of the cabinet this mouse trap. I was horrified, because when I looked down at this monstrosity, all I saw was Stuart Little's neck getting snapped in two. So I made my moral headline case, as only a petulant 9-year-old can, whining and stomping my feet. And my mom gave in. She purchased a more humane mousetrap, and we made it a big Sunday afternoon, driving Mr. Stuart Little into the countryside for release into the area dirt farms. Then I promptly forgot everything, and a couple of weeks later, when I saw the horror trap set to trap some other vermin, I couldn't care less. When I was 19, I was living in this dingy little apartment, and I had just rolled out of bed one day when I saw, sitting on the wall, a cockroach. So I reached for the shoe and held it hovering over this cockroach. But then I froze, because I'd recently been reading the works of Franz Kafka. And when I looked down at this cockroach, all I heard coming back to me were the wailings of Gregor Samsa in the Metamorphosis. And I didn't know what to do, because frankly, I couldn't make heads or tails of just what Gregor Samsa was trying to tell me. But he seemed to be having a miserable time of things. I thought it might be cruel not to smash him with my shoe. But then I wondered if this wasn't just a rationalization, that maybe Gregor Samsa wouldn't be best left smoldering in his own slime mold for another 60 pages. But then something looked a little off, and I grabbed my glasses and saw more clearly. Oh, this is just a damn spider. And that's how Charlotte met the acquaintance of Mr. Shoup. Okay. Should I go on or?
You got 4 minutes?
What the hell. A bit of dark humor here. 28 ways to end a conversation. Number one, pick your nose. Number two, now stick your finger in your ear. Number three, now put your finger in your mouth. Number four, refer to this as a triple penetration shot. Number five, and smells.
Thank you.